This episode of No Wrong Answers is brought to you by Teach for America Kansas City, which believes teachers deserve to be celebrated and their voices elevated. Find out how you can join their movement of passionate educators in Kansas City by going to teachforamerica.org or find us on Twitter at @TFA_KC or on Instagram at @TFAKC.
President Donald Trump accused of lying.
Well, no, I was told, I was given that information. I don't know. I was just given. We had a very, very big margin.
What can teachers teach the media? Betsy DeVos is our education secretary. Do protest against her help or hurt?
Don't let her in the public schools right now.
Shame, 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 shame.
And 50 Shades of Grey, the movies and the books, are its themes seen in our schools?
No spoilers, let's just say the sequel lives up to the hype, and the world premiere was quite an event. It was a swanky 50 Shades-themed masquerade ball.
Those topics plus kids these days on this episode of the No Wrong Answers podcast. Welcome to episode 5 of No Wrong Answers, the weekly podcast that has real teachers hash out the big news stories of the day and their impact on the classroom. I'm your host, Kyle Palmer. I'm a former teacher turned public radio journalist, and I'm joined, as always, by a group of hardworking teachers who are ready to talk. So let's introduce them. Maddie Burkemper, what do you teach?
I teach fourth grade.
All of it.
I always feel like there's a big pause. That's it.
Yep. Princeton Grayson, what do you teach?
Middle school advanced academics.
And Jason Stiliga, what do you teach?
I'm a secondary honors and advanced placement educator whose focus is in the biological and physical sciences.
That was practice. Well, you guys,
This is his first time here.
And he's already showed you two up. Yeah. So you raise your game.
What do you need to add on to fourth grade? There's nothing else I could say.
All three of them are public school teachers in the Kansas City metro area. Well, let's get to it. Falsehoods, untruths, plain old lying. The national conversation about telling and not telling the truth has taken on added fervor since the election of Donald Trump, as Political Magazine pointed out during the presidential campaign. Pulitzer Prize-winning PolitiFact categorized 70% of Trump's statements on the campaign trail as false and just 4% as completely true. And a certain kind of falsehood that Trump has repeated a lot since his election was again stated recently by one of his top advisors, Stephen Miller, speaking on ABC News this week with George Stephanopoulos.
President Trump again this week suggested in a meeting with senators that thousands of illegal voters were bused from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. Do you have that evidence?
I can tell you that this issue of busing voters into New Hampshire is widely known by anyone who's worked in New Hampshire politics.
Do you have any evidence
to back
that up?
Talk to anybody who's worked in politics there for a long time.
It wasn't just the lie itself that Miller told. Claims of massive voter fraud have been routinely and easily debunked since Trump and his team began making them soon after the election. It was the way in which it was told, bold-faced, confidently, without compunction, with a kind of panache many teachers might recognize, as The Daily Show's Trevor Noah put it.
This is such a high school tactic for trying to defend a lie. Becky is the biggest slut ever. You can ask, like, anybody. Do you have proof? Yeah, like, you ask, like, anybody.
So our first topic for our teachers at the table, is there something in the brazen nature of Stephen Miller's falsehoods that you recognize? Princeton Grayson, you have a good story.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of one of my third graders I taught before a couple years ago, who just bold-faced lied about another student cutting his hair.
He said that another student cut his hair in class.
And I'm a very attentive teacher, so I know that did not happen. And so what it ended up doing is causing a lot of chaos with the parent and a little bit of confusion. It took us about a week to actually get the student to admit that this did not take place in class and that he did it himself and not someone else.
And why do you think he sustained that lie for a week?
Oh, because he was fearful of his mother. Because if he would have admitted that he did it, he would have gotten in trouble. So it was a lot easier to place the blame elsewhere.
Maddie, you work with fourth graders. I'm sure you've experienced a lot of playground lies, backs and forth between kids. What's your experience?
Yeah, a lot of the students who lie in fourth grade tend to really, the more they say it, the more they really believe that what they're saying is what actually happened or that what they're saying is true. And so I feel like part of my job is one, helping them accept that what happened happened and that they need to accept it and own it and grow from that experience. And two, helping them go through that process in a way that makes them feel respected and safe. So I use a lot of like reframing and questioning to get to a starting point so that we can have a conversation about character.
So give me like a concrete example of maybe a conversation you've had with a kid.
So one of my students was on the playground and got into a yelling match with another student, and he like yelled an insult at someone else in my classroom. And so I pulled him off to the side and said, hey, like I saw this happening. And he got very defensive and was like, I didn't do anything. I don't even know why you called me over here. And most of the time my technique is, I'm like, I'm not going to yell at you. We need to own the problem so that we can fix the problem. So I'll ask questions like, when I was looking at you, were you standing close to the student or far away? I'll say, well, I was really close. It's like, were you using a yelling loud voice or were you using a calm voice? I'll say, well, I was yelling. I was like, so if we're standing close to someone else and we're using a yelling voice, what's that called? And I'll say, fighting. So then now I have a defined term, fighting. I'll go, okay, so if I saw you fighting, what does a responsible teacher do? Ignore the fight or confront the fight? He's like, well, a responsible teacher should confront the fight. I'm like, would I confront it because I care about? And this goes on. I mean, I could.
This sounds very Socratic.
I could keep going. And eventually we get to the point where I have the student label what happened as an inappropriate fighting confrontation that is not okay. And then once we've defined what happened, so essentially I lead the student to the truth of what I saw. And then once we've defined that, then we can move on. And I say, we need to own it, we need to apologize for it, and then we need to make a plan so that this doesn't keep happening in the room.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people in, for lack of a better term, the national news media upset at having to deal with the Trump administration and what they perceive to be very frequent, brazen, bold-faced, easily debunked lies of the type that we heard from Stephen Miller just a few minutes ago. I guess, what as teachers have you learned about dealing with that type of line where there might be an underlying cause for it, but still you have to deal with it in the moment? What have you learned about combating that other people who aren't teachers might want to hear about?
Do you have something?
Go for it.
Okay. The thing that I'm most struck by is that I am dealing with similar lies, but the people who are making those lies are in fourth grade. They're 9 and 10. So,
and to be clear, you have the power.
Yeah.
Right? That's another caveat,
so
right?
So the Socratic method that I just described, I'm watching newscasters attempt to do that same thing with like Kellyanne Conway or Miller about these lies. And the fact is they're not 9 and 10. And they're not making those lies out of fear. Like, my students lie to me because they don't know how I'm going to react to them. So, you know, in August, they're lying to me because they're like, what's Miss B going to do to me? I'm like, I'm not going to.
At the beginning of the school year, they're kind of testing you
out
a little bit.
But these politicians, they are not children. And they're lying so that they can get to a different end. And the whole lie that we keep hearing about voter fraud is being told so that eventually you can get support and pass legislation to disenfranchise minorities from voting, from having their voting rights. So I see these newscasters trying to hold these politicians accountable the way that I would a 9-year-old. And I really wish that they would skip that Socratic method and go straight to the punchline of, we all know you're lying. Why are you doing it? You're doing it to disenfranchise people of color from their voting rights.
Two things. So Maddie said something about Kellyanne Conway, and I've had a lot of discussion about message boxes. And so in class and then in just outside work that I do. And message boxes are there designed to get a point across. The more you hear it, the more you believe it.
I agree.
And the whole purpose of Kellyanne during the campaign was to repeat the same message over and over and over again so that people would hear that same message over and over and over again. And she was successful because she didn't deviate from the message.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is actual research that shows, I believe it's Harvard's Daniel Gilbert. Actually, I had this study ready to go in case I needed it, that the repetition of a false statement actually reinforces that to the point where it becomes more true in the minds of the listeners. This point you bring up about this Socratic method, you know, we actually saw this just a few days ago before the taping of this at Trump's press conference when he was, falsely claiming about the size of his electoral victory, and a reporter actually got into a Socratic discussion with him about it at this press conference. Let's listen.
Today, you had the biggest electoral margin since Ronald Reagan, 304 306 electoral votes. And back to President Obama, about 365.
Well, I'm talking about Republican. Yeah.
Yeah. George H.W. Bush, 426 when he won as president. So why should Americans...
Well, no, I was told, I was given that information. I don't know. I was just given. We had a very, very big margin.
You know, in that clip we just heard, Maddie, there seems to be an agreement on the actual facts, mm-hmm. but a disagreement over what those facts mean. And is that something that you run into with kids, fourth graders?
Sometimes. I run into a lot more of the repeating a lie in multiple different ways to not arrive at a fact. Like,
Because I'm a member of the media. What could the media learn from the way you all deal with liars in class?
I think they need to learn how to diffuse the lie. I don't see a lot of success with the media knowing how to diffuse the lie, because all the news segments I'm seeing are just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then we're like, well, these are alternative facts. And then it...
I think agree to disagree.
Let's shake hands and move on. I'm like, no, that's not...
They haven't done a good job of naming it just flat out. Like, this is a lie, and let's move on from here and, like,
diffuse.
Move forward. It is a lot of just, well, we'll just agree to disagree and we'll accept it. And so that acceptance makes it perpetuates the ability for them to continue lying. In my classroom, yes. I did not accept it. I will not accept it. And so it made us get back to that point of, okay, you lied about this. And, like, how do we recover from here? We never recover because we never acknowledge. We are so nice about it. The media so nice about it. Oh, that's a falsehood. Or you're telling falseness. Like, no, he's telling a lie.
Jason? And
I think the media, too, they can't jump on everything that gets presented to them.
Right.
You know, if you're going to debunk a lie, you need to choose a focus and in the direction that you want to move. And then sometimes trying to use facts to diffuse the lie doesn't seem to work. Mm-hmm. At least it doesn't seem to work in our time at the moment. But, you know, it's so important that we stay on course and we continue to educate to the best of our abilities. And I think that's really what media can do, is that they just continue to present the facts, and they present them, and they present them, and they present them. And it goes back to what we said before, that repetition of the facts, and people will start to listen, and people will start to engage, mm-hmm. and you will see that the truth will come out.
Yes.
I will say, though, I think as they continue to repeat the facts, like it minimizes the impact of a true fact. When you bring other people who are repeating alternative facts. And so when they continue to invite liars to the table, then it diminishes the truth at all.
We have started to see media organizations say for certain individuals, Kellyanne Conway namely, that they will not be invited back on shows for that very reason. And I will say, in the media's defense, National Public Radio's Mary Louise Kelly actually had a very interesting take on air on Morning Edition a few weeks ago about why she does not use the term lie in her story. She uses the term falsehood because, by the dictionary definition of lie, you have to know intent. It's about intent or the reason behind the lie. And she, as a reporter, is not
inside. I feel like I do know the intent. They're
right,
lying.
Yeah.
They're creating a voter fraud problem that does not exist. There is legislation slated to pass that will take away voter rights.
I appreciate that. Okay. I will look
it
that
is
up.
So clearly linked for me. They do not want people of color and minorities to vote. They are making a lie about voter fraud.
The response to that is that once a lie is repeated enough, then you can start to infer intent.
Okay.
You can start to call it a lie if they are doing it enough, which I don't, you know, I mean.
I understand you're a journalist, so I'm just going to, I'll say it for both, well, I will say it for myself because I can't officially say.
Do we need to walk Trump to the spot on the playground where he was?
No, and that's my point. We're treating them like we're going to one day be able to make them own it and move. And I'm like, you aren't going to get Kellyanne Conway to own her lie. Move on. Not like, don't.
But what does that mean?
I don't mean move on.
Because she's going to be there.
I mean, like, I liked what Jason said. Like, you say, that is a lie. Okay, so Kellyanne Conway lies. Maybe you try. That's a lie. And then state the fact.
They should just have like a in their what is it called at the bottom of the screen?
The crawl.
The yes. Fact checker. Fact
they should just every time have a fact checker. That's a lot.
And I will say that's a lot of resources because there's a lot of untruths and falses.
What is democracy?
Exactly.
What is democracy worth to you?
It's a lot of resources.
What is it worth?
Hey, we're on the same side on that one. It's a lot of resources.
People that I talk to, like when I talk to my mom about this, another white female, she goes, she exhausts out. We talk about for 3 hours and I get very impassioned and I'm like, we need to talk about these issues, mom. And I get, and eventually she goes, oh, can't we just have a nice dinner? And I'm like, you know what? You can, but
that's how they win.
Your voter rights are not in peril right now. And that's why there's this like, this can be okay. So I'm like, yes, let's throw all of our resources to the fact checker. All of it. If my voter rights were in peril, that's what I would want. I would want fact checkers. I'd want a whole army of people telling everybody else to amp up.
Well, you could say that for a large chunk of America, fact checking doesn't do it. Fact checking doesn't. I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but that they.
They're not persuaded by it.
I would feel comfortable saying it doesn't matter.
I feel like I could make that.
I think because it tells the message that we're not just accepting. I think right now when we allow the Kellyannes and the Stevens to go on air and continue to perpetuate these bold-faced lies, mm-hmm. it makes it seem like we're almost co-signing them. And so to have that caveat that we know that we're naming this actually a lie, but we're going to let you speak. Like, we're going to give you your space, but we need to name the fact that we're not accepting it as truth either.
And what do we teach students? You know, if you're a bystander, what are you? You are part of the problem.
Say that to me.
You are part of the problem. If you are on the playground and you do not report, you do not stand up, you do not empathize, not even empathize. No, I do mean empathize. Sympathy and empathize. We want to empathize. But if you do not choose an action in response to what you have seen or in what you have heard, you are a part of the problem. You are creating a group of people who has become complacent. And by becoming complacent, you are saying, this is okay with me.
I mean, Jason, that gets to what you were talking about integrity earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always tell my students, when you stop talking, they stop listening.
Yes.
And so to that point of fact checking, you know, you don't stop, right? There may be people who quit reading, but there are still readers out there who are going to rely on that information for them to know the truth. And so it's not done in vain. I mean, it's done to maintain democracy across this country.
Well, we'll leave it there. These are the people teaching your kids, folks. So they have a lot going on. Yeah. They have a lot going on, but a great conversation. I'm sure that will not be the last time we bring up falsehoods, untruths, and lies.
Lies.
Our podcast today is sponsored by Teach for America Kansas City, which believes one day all children will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. You can make an impact on that mission in Kansas City. To find out how, visit teachforamerica.org or find us on Twitter at @TFA_KC and on Instagram at @TFAKC. Well, like it or lump it, and I will say all the teachers we've talked to on this program fall in the second category. Betsy DeVos is our nation's education secretary. Of course, there are a lot of educators and activists who have a problem with that. One of the more notable incidents of DeVos's first week on the job was when she tried to visit Jefferson Middle School Academy in Washington, D.C., and was prevented from going inside the school by a group of protesters. They greeted her with shouts of shame and signs that read things like, "We love our public schools." This is what DeVos had to say about the incident a few days later while giving a speech at the Magnet Schools of America conference.
The protesters' behavior, I think, is a reflection on the way some seek to treat our education system today, by keeping kids in and new thinking out. Friday's incident demonstrates just how hostile some people are to change and to new ideas.
Former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, who served for years under President Barack Obama, tweeted out, "Agree or disagree with Betsy DeVos, let's all agree she needs to be in public schools. Please let her in." Randy Weingarten, the head of the AFT, no fan of DeVos, tweeted out similar sentiments. Now, DeVos actually did get to go inside Jefferson Academy and went into some classrooms. After leaving, she said she could tell the attitude of the teachers was more of a, quote, receive mode. They are waiting to be told what they have to do, and that's not going to bring success to an individual child. That's what she said. Teachers and administrators took exception in the Washington Post and in tweets afterwards. They refuted DeVos's characterization, as one teacher put it. Maybe if she knew more about education, she would realize just how amazing the students, teachers, and staff here are. Phew. Well, it was a rocky start to Betsy DeVos's tenure as education secretary. To my teachers at the table, first this issue of protesters, at least at first, blocking her from getting inside that school. In your opinion, is that helpful or harmful to the case many are making in opposition to Betsy DeVos?
I don't think that they're helpful necessarily. I think that they are. I don't have an issue with them. I don't think they help the long term, though. I think that if we're really wanting to build an ally with DeVos, then we have to be able to educate her, and that means we have to give her access to see what brilliant things are going on in classrooms. I wouldn't want, as a teacher, I wouldn't want her to stop. I would want her to be in my classroom to see what I'm doing so that she knows that great things are taking place in public education. At the same time, I definitely think that protesters have a right, and I think they should be able to leverage that right to express themselves.
Matt, I'm going to go back to you because I see the skeptical look on your face.
I disagree.
Tell me more.
because she was given access, and she was given access to a school that is labeled as a rising school in the district, that she was given access to teachers who have helped students grow multiple grade levels in 1 year. So she saw what we want her to see, that public schools are successful for minorities, that public schools can be successful with the system that they have in competition with a charter or a private school. And when she exited that
school,
she said the exact opposite. She said that they were in receive mode. She said that they didn't have what it takes to educate those students. So,
So to that point, I think that's a valid point. I don't disagree. When I think about access, it's not just coming and do a walkthrough. It's similar to what a principal would do. That they wouldn't just come do a walkthrough and make a final decision about your effectiveness as an educator. It requires conversation. And so I think, and I don't know if they did have a conversation with her or have like some panel discussion, but that would be the next layer for me, especially for someone who's so inexperienced in that sector, that I would want her to observe me as I teach and then have a conversation afterwards so she would know that there is no receivership here. I take initiative.
Jason.
I came in thinking that it was neither harmful nor counterproductive about the protests, but I've listened to Princeton and Maddie, and I now believe that the protests were helpful. And they're helpful in this way, which is our young people don't often see civic activism in public. They see it on television, and it doesn't necessarily make the connection with them, that real connection. And when they see individuals outside of their school, and Princeton, you hit on this earlier, community members outside their school.
From their classroom window.
From their classroom window.
In real time.
They feel valued.
And exactly, fighting for them, that's the piece. Because when we often see it on TV, it's not about our kids. It's not about me. And so now when they see them outside of their classroom, it's about them. I agree.
Okay. And this is where, coming back to our disagreement from earlier, I am not pro cutting off access. I'm very pro keeping her out of the classroom. The immediate.
Is that not the same thing?
Listening to you, I don't think it's the same thing anymore. I think it starts with her having conversations with educators. I would love to have all of the teachers, principals, superintendents, and Betsy DeVos come together to talk. Like a town hall meeting. I think that is exactly what we need. I would not want Betsy DeVos to come into the classroom and then for them to hear the news about her after she visited their building, took pictures with them, read a book to them, met them, shook their hands, leaned over their desk, said, "Oh, what are you working on there?" And then leave and then insult the teacher, insult the school, show that she does not have an understanding, that she didn't grow from it. To me, that's her getting access to a school that is becoming successful, and then disparaging it. And I'm not okay with that, because why would I want
I agree. I'm not okay with that either. I think that part of her growth has to be also observation, and so part of that access has to include classroom and student interaction. Because if she doesn't see that part, then she's going to continue to devalue and not think that it's there.
And I think that
it just can't be done in isolation. It cannot be done in isolation. So you can't just go walk through a building and say, "Oh, I read a book." No, you need to have conversations. You need to engage.
I agree.
To that point, is there anything that she could do now to build your trust? Jason, are you looking for evidence of what she could do to build trust with you?
Talking with the students. It goes back to working in an urban environment.
We've already noticed a couple episodes
urban?
Ago at Princeton said, what is urban? Yeah.
The story of the kids and the plight of the kids is so important to the way teachers interact with their kids and within that school setting. You know, she walks into Jefferson and she maybe goes 10 minutes, 20 minutes into a classroom. She has no idea of the backgrounds of the students who are working in those schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you, an individual who wants to engage and who wants to learn is going to take time and take that effort to present situations where they're going to be able to take something away and grow as an individual. For her to get my trust, it's going to have to be an absolute demonstration that she believes in each student in every zip code across this country.
Yeah. Well, this DeVos conversation is not over, I'm sure. In fact, I encourage you to go back and listen to some of our past episodes, especially our special extra credit from a couple weeks ago when she was confirmed as Education Secretary, our immediate response to that confirmation. This will be an ongoing conversation for weeks for sure. On Valentine's Day recently, the movie 50 Shades Darker earned $11 million in box office receipts on just that one Tuesday night. The sequel to 2014's 50 Shades of Grey has already raked in $150 million or so in total revenue. Now, that's not record-setting, but it's pretty good for a sequel that heavily features themes of BDSM and has been widely panned by critics. Of course, the 50 Shades phenomenon began in book form. It's a trilogy of Twilight fan fiction, if you want to look into it, that has alternately been credited with opening up American society to more liberated sexual mores and also has been blasted for giving young people especially a model for unhealthy, controlling relationships. Now, we don't want to talk about the movie or the books per se, though I understand Maddie has actually read the books.
I have. Just the very, very first one.
But we do want to use this as an entree into a discussion about a topic that can often be uncomfortable for teachers, and that is sex ed. But, Maddie, you have read the books.
I have.
What types of what messages do you think it sends?
Really unhealthy messages. The relationship between, I can't remember their names, but the relationship between the two.
Not a good sign.
Between the two characters is very unhealthy. It's very controlling. It's very, it's just all over bad.
Yeah. Does it mirror messages that kids get from media in general? Like what messages of sex and relationships do kids get from media nowadays?
As a female, the message that you get from the media is that sex lasts about 1 minute. That was pretty reflected in the book. Like you'd read half a page and it was like, we're done. Everyone is walking away happy and fulfilled from this. And in the media, it's like a minute to 5 minutes that every single female orgasms from vaginal intercourse, and like that's all that you need. That it's just very, the message that I get is very pro straight male. This is how it's done. It's successful for every woman, regardless of sexual orientation or race, that's it.
Well, and I imagine that sets up high expectations.
Yeah, and those expectations aren't accurate. And I don't feel like, at least for me personally, in my education about sex, I wasn't exposed to anything other than this is your period and that's how it works. And this is what happens when you contract an STD. And this is how you deal with it.
What are some of the biggest misunderstandings that kids have about relationships? Because it's not just about the act of sex itself that kind of hits upon some criticisms that I've heard of 50 Shades of Grey, but it's also this idea of a controlling relationship or a relationship that's not healthy. what are some misunderstandings that kids have about what a relationship should look like?
I mean, given that, you know, they're teenagers still developing and their minds are still growing, I think that one of the things I see most prevalent within this, with my students, is that they think because they're in a relationship, like that equals ownership of one another. And like, you didn't ask me to do this, or you didn't ask me to do that. How did you do this? And so they try to control the actions of others instead of just like working through that and processing it together. And also gives them this false sense of how you can touch me and how you can engage with me is very, what's the word I'm looking for? It just creates a lot of opportunities for conflict because there's not a full understanding of how two individuals come together.
At the high school level, what does that look like?
Like relationships?
Yeah.
You know, there is some of that sense of like, you know, we have two people together. Oh my God! You looked at another person. Mm-hmm. That creates the situation. To the idea of, you know, sex can be instant gratification, but it's not the elements of the relationship. You know, and when you're working with high schoolers or with your friends, you know, you talk about the elements that are important in a relationship. Mm-hmm. Sex isn't the relationship. The relationship is the friendship. It's the connection. It's the trust. It's the love you feel for one another. It's the ability to share your emotions and your feelings. And sex becomes a natural part of that relationship over the course of time. But sex for high schoolers shouldn't start off as the beginning of the relationship. Yeah. And you have to make sure that you're aware of that. And as you see kids in the hallway, or they're holding hands, or they're getting too close to each other, you know, you need to have a discussion with those kids in that hallway about their behavior to make sure that they understand.
Oh, what does that? What does that sound like? What is that? I mean, in that moment, what do you have to say?
The Socratic method.
No, go back to the Socratic.
How close were you standing?
I hope not.
Two hands apart, please.
Do you talk? Does consent come up? I mean, it's certainly at the secondary level, do you have to have conversations about consent?
It's surprising how much the kids know.
Really?
In regards to consent.
In what ways? What are they?
Well, they can have conversations about, you know, child A and child B being together. And they know if it's right or they know it's wrong. And they know that if one is 16 and the other one is 19 or something like that, they are firmly aware of the responsibility that each student has in terms of what their relationship is going to be with another student.
And does that affect their
behavior? Which I was really surprised at, that these kids would be like, yeah, I mean, this is wrong.
And does that affect their behavior? If they're looking at another person's relationship and is able to break it down that way, does that affect their behavior and decisions?
You would hope so.
In middle school, not so much. Consent is often talked about through the form of sexual harassment because it's a lot of touching and people are trying to pet one another. And so it becomes that when someone says no, what does that mean? Or when they say they're not playing anymore, like, when do you draw the line? And so sometimes our students are not able to distinguish between, oh, they're joking no, and like they're just, I can keep going, and they're actually serious about, I said no, so stop touching me, stop pushing me, stop being around me. And so the conversation becomes more about sexual harassment than it does about like the act of sex itself.
Maddie, you teach fourth grade, but did these issues come up?
Consent?
Or, I mean, anything that we've been talking about, yeah.
Not through the same lens, but I think in a way that it really builds onto their understanding, hopefully, so that when they come to Princeton or Jason's classroom, they're prepared for that conversation through a sexual lens. So, like, touching someone else's hair, picking up someone else's backpack. We talk about consent where, like, I can tell that someone's in someone else's personal space, and I'll say, we respect personal space. And I'll say it very, like, that's where I choose to have a power stance, and I am very firm, and I say it loud enough so that everyone can hear. And I say, in this classroom, we respect personal space. And then they move back and apologize, and we establish that. Or a lot of times in grade school, I was told as a young girl, like, oh, so-and-so is tapping you or pushing you or chasing you and won't stop, it's because that person likes you. So and I do not let those conversations happen. I say, if you feel uncomfortable, if you do not want to be chased, if you do not want to be included in this game of tag, boys to boys, girls to girls, boys back and forth, it's anyone, you have the right to say no. You have the right for that no to be respected. And I will back you up on that no. So I'll have a conversation with both of them, and then
That's interesting.
You know,
so
we'll follow up.
So, I mean, sex per se is not the subject of those conversations,
no.
And it doesn't come up, but it is kind of an undertone in establishing mm-hmm. behaviors and boundaries that would theoretically eventually affect someone's sexual behaviors.
Well, and it's really impactful because when the students hear me say that so firmly and we have conversations about that, you hear that same conversation echoed in their conversations to another. Mm-hmm. And that really brings me, that's like a warm, fuzzy moment for me as an educator when I walk by the lunchroom table and I hear one of my students very loudly say, "My no meant no." And then everyone like, well, allow that space to happen. Or when someone else sees something happening and they'll go, "We respect personal space." And I'm like, yeah, get them. Like, it's good for that culture for all students of all sexual orientations and genders to really understand that they have their bubble and that that bubble will be and should be respected.
Jason, final word?
I like the idea you set ground rules. Mm-hmm. And that is fantastic. And you're right. As you move through the years, I think what's even more important is that not only do you have Maddie doing it, you have their fifth grade teacher doing it, and you have your sixth grade teacher doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important that professional development in school districts actually goes through and talks about that with the educators so they know the importance of consent and they know the importance of appropriate behavior as those kids move through the years.
Oh, well, we'll leave that conversation there. Very interesting. You can read or see the 50 Shades movies if you want, but have these conversations and questions in mind as you do. So we'll end this episode with a segment we end each episode with called Kids These Days. Our teachers tell us about the things trending among their students. It's a window into the world of teachers' sometimes strange lives. So each week we ask our teachers, what are the kids into these days? Maddie, we'll start us off this time. What are your kids into these days?
Okay, so disclaimer, everyone listening needs to close their... Well, if you're driving, don't do this. But you need to find a way to metaphorically close your eyes and connect back with the fourth grader inside of you. Okay. And because all of my kids these days, you have to connect because otherwise I won't disclaim. You are in fourth grade right now. Speaking directly to you, I've broken the wall through the earbuds. Anyways, I have a bunch of kids who are super into commercials right now and repeating those taglines over and over and over again to the point of just hysteria. And one day, a group of boys approached my door to come on in. They always wait for each other. And that day, they were laughing so hard. They were just, tears were streaming down their face. They couldn't stand up. And so after they'd calmed down and stood up, I said, "Hey, guys, what's going on this morning? Like, what's so funny?" And one of them, like, coughed the words out and just said, "Arby's." And then the other kid responded with, "We have the meats." And then they both fell down and started laughing again. And when they stood up the second time, one kid said, "Toyota." And the other kid went, "Going places." And that happened.
And this was the joke.
That's why you had to connect with your fourth grade self. That's the whole joke. And so I got some like teacher cred because I went, "Your morning work, Nike, just do it." And then they all laughed again. And it was hilarious, but you had to have been there.
You had to have been there.
I'm going to have nightmares of Ms. Dupchak, my fourth grade teacher. Thank you.
Jason, what are your kids into these days?
So I do Song of the Day in my classroom every day, and all the kids have been talking about the last 2 or 3 weeks is J. Cole dropping a new album. And so we've spent a lot of time after school during tutoring listening to J. Cole.
Can you let me look who you're talking to. Can you explain that more?
Dropping of an album.
I understand. I understand what dropping of an album.
J. Cole is. Response.
Come on.
Which one of those words?
I'm not that out of it. Princeton, what are your kids into these days?
So right now, my boys are into claiming everyone as their children. So everyone is their son or their daughter, which is very weird. Well, they're teachers and students, so they'll be like, "Yo, that's my son over there. What up, son? How you doing, son?" And so, that's they just like to claim people right now.
What is this? What is this?
I don't get it either. I don't know where it comes from.
It's not like a meme or a social media thing?
Not that I'm aware of, but it is just a current thing that everyone is their son or daughter. And it makes other kids very upset. Like, they get extremely... Stop calling me your son. Like, some people, it's almost like fighting words for them. But they do it to teachers, too. "Yo, that's my son over there. What up, Mr. So-and-so? That's my son." It's like, it's just very...
This is different from saying, like, "What up, son?"
Yeah, completely different. It's, okay. They say it in the sense that they're your father, your dad.
That's like a power move.
I guess. Maybe so. I never considered it that way. But
that's why other kids get upset.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. That could be very well the case.
Do they say that to you?
Oh, yeah, they've called me their son.
What do you do?
I just laugh it off. It doesn't bother me.
That's what I would do.
We just had that conversation about sex ed and relationships, though.
Well, that was before I processed it in that manner.
Back in the day when they used to be like, what up, cuz?
Right. But it's not just a greeting because it's like, oh, son, I said sit down. Like, they try to really. So maybe
yeah, it's a power move. It's a definite power move. Yeah.
Well, I don't buy into
Per the suggestion from my producer Matt in my ear.
Yeah, so I don't buy into it.
For it to be a power move, you have to
give them the power. React. And I just like sit down.
Okay. Well, that'll do it for this episode of No Wrong Answers. We will have our weekly extra credit segment drop this Wednesday. This week it is a special edition. We have a one-on-one interview with Jane Elliott, the teacher who famously taught her students the blue eyes, brown eyes lesson the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. She's been teaching that lesson in workshops and lecturing about it ever since. How has the meaning of blue eyes, brown eyes changed since the election of Donald Trump? Well, she talks about that plus much more. Look for that on Wednesday. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, just search for the No Wrong Answers podcast by Fountain City Frequency, find us at iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. Once you find us, subscribe to the podcast, and this is important, leave us a review. It helps. There are no other podcasts like ours giving you a teacherly take on the world. If you've enjoyed this conversation you've heard, subscribe, leave us a review, and keep the conversation going. Thanks to our teachers this week, Maddie Burkemper, Princeton Grayson, and Jason Staliga. Thanks to Matt Hodapp, who produces the podcast. I'm Kyle Palmer, and remember, kids, be nice to your teachers.